Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday for you. It's a Friday for us because we have mastered the art of time travel here on the Writer's Block. And with me here tonight is Jason Kessler. Now, a reminder, this is not a live stream. We are not live. You're seeing a premiere of a show recorded earlier. Jason has some things to attend to on Sunday, but he has graciously agreed to take part in this experiment. The first time we are using StreamYard's pre-recording technology here on the Writer's Block. Jason, how are you doing tonight?
Fantastic. Good to be back on your program.
Well, I'm glad to have you back, and I wish it were under happier circumstances, but unfortunately, things are the way they are on the happy ship of the dissident right. But before we get into it, I would like to remind our listeners and viewers that just because we're not streaming live doesn't mean that you cannot and should not donate. Now, you always have the Entropy link and you always have Cash App on Entropy. You can send donations. You can even send questions. And next week, I might come around to answering them, or you know, Greg will answer them during Countercurrents Radio. Whereas Cash App, you can just give us money out of the goodness of your heart. So if you want to contribute to the Countercurrents fundraiser, because we are raising funds, we are rapidly approaching the end of the year, and we're going to have to get a little sprint in that final stretch of the fundraiser, because we are lagging a little behind, so we would appreciate your help. Now, you can also use MoonPay to donate. MoonPay is what you do. You take your fiat currency, and they allow you to transform it into any form of cryptocurrency, and it goes straight into the Countercurrents wallets. And then there's also DLive and Odyssey. While this is going out live on DLive and Odyssey, you can still donate Lemons, Ninjets, Ninja Genies over on DLive as well as Odyssey. They allow you to donate cash money or Library Coin, which is their very own cryptocurrency, and that's greatly appreciated. Now, all those are all the direct ways to donate to Countercurrents. There's also an indirect way, and that is to purchase the fine products of our sponsor, our friends and sponsors, Alaska Chaga. What a delicious beverage. It's full of antioxidants. It's good for your immune system, apparently. Certainly works for me. Puts me right out. Well, you know, every time after the Writer's Block, I'm out like a log, and not just because I'm tired, because I'm actually energized by this thing. And Alaska Chaga helps me get down from the high of performing this service for you week after weary week. So with all those crass financial concerns out of the way, let's get into it. Jason, first of all, what have you been up to since your last appearance on the Writer's Block? I hear you've been starting some new things.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I work for a living, and so things are very busy for me during the spring and summer, and then I have a little bit more free time during the winter, and I've decided to really try to dedicate myself towards getting back in the game of Dissident Right. I started a new program called Happenings with Jason Kessler, which can be viewed through a simulcast on Telegram, Twitter, and DLive. Re-uploads are on BitChute and Odyssey. And with that program, I've been trying to cover the latest happenings, just like the title, but also to get into some more philosophical issues. I had David Duke on to speak about why he should be allowed by Elon Musk back onto Twitter. We covered sort of the LGBT agenda of the globalists being enacted against the people of Qatar during the World Cup. I've covered some of the Kanye Fuentes situation that we're going to be talking about today, and a myriad of other topics. And so I would highly encourage people to check that out. All the links are on jasonkessler.us.
Right. It's a wonderful program, and I've been on as well during the midterm elections. We were speculating. We were spitballing. I had a great time on Jason Kessler's Happenings, and I heartily recommend that everyone go and check it out. Watch it on DLive. Watch it on Telegram. Our admins will, of course, be providing all of these links for everyone in the chat during the show premiere, or I hope so. You know, who knows what will happen during the show premiere. But I think that without further ado, we should get into it. Jason, things have been happening. Initially, we wanted to discuss this whole interplay between Elon Musk and America First. This has been a subject many times on the writer's block before. We have kept a very close eye on Elon Musk's dealings with Twitter, and we have also kept an eye on America First as it, well, descended into what it is today, even though initially I thought, you know, maybe this Fuentes kid knows what he's doing. But no, at this point, I don't think I can say that in good faith. And now, by the time we actually got around to recording this program, what we have now is Kanye West has been thrown into the mix. He has appeared on Alex Jones, and he's another one of our favorite bugaboos here on the writer's block and the whole Carney culture he represents. And for his appearance on Alex Jones, where he basically made a spectacle of himself wearing a gimp mask, and you could say he was speaking about the Jews, but I would say more he was ranting in an unhinged manner about not just the Jews, but everything. And he has been banned off of Twitter. Kanye West has been banned off of Twitter. But this all started when Elon Musk first tweeted out a picture of Baked Alaska saluting a McDonald's restaurant and then deleted it. And I just want to get your first impression, your impression of what do you think that meant, Jason? What's going on over there between Elon Musk and Baked Alaska?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, first of all, I'm sure your viewers are very aware of the fact that Baked Alaska has had a problem with being right next to people who are about to be charged with federal crimes in multiple situations, whether it be Charlottesville, where he was one of the few speakers that escaped getting a federal lawsuit served on him, whether it was being in a secret chat with Ricky Vaughn, also known as Douglas Mackey, where Vaughn was charged with federal election interference and Baked Alaska was mysteriously left alone, even though he was named in the court documents by the DOJ, or whether it was the fact that many of the J6 protesters, probably a majority of them who were charged, were identified through screen caps of Baked Alaska's live stream, despite being one of the most high profile individuals who had marched in Charlottesville, a prominent member of Nicholas Fuentes's America First movement. Baked Alaska is one of the few people not detained without trial. He was let go to go around the country and pepper spray people in the face and do all kinds of crazy stuff. And he did not ultimately serve any time in jail. He pled guilty to a lesser charge in exchange for his agreement to cooperate as a federal informant for the DOJ against other January 6th protesters. Since that time, Nicholas Fuentes has not distanced himself from Baked Alaska. He's prominently featured Baked Alaska in streams. He's put him up as a featured act on his Cozy website and basically promoted Baked Alaska as somebody to look up to this movement of young men and kids that follow Fuentes and hang on his every word. So, as you said, Elon Musk tweeted out a picture, which was Baked Alaska from behind. Many people could tell what it was. I guess it was supposed to be sort of a tease to generate excitement, similar to what we saw when there was the reveal of Milo Yiannopoulos working with Kanye West, or the reveal of Nicholas Fuentes working with Kanye West, where it was like made to appear, I think intentionally, like it was just an accident. Like when Milo was photographed with Kanye, it looks like it's just the paparazzi taking a picture of these two together in the street. But online researchers have revealed that basically the guy who photographed, yes, he is a photographer, but he's the father of Baked Alaska's girlfriend. So this was a setup, you know, made to look accidental to generate excitement. Similarly, at the point that there were blurry images of Fuentes in the background of Kanye West's streams, they knew that Fuentes was going to be an integral part of their operation, what they're calling Kanye West's presidential campaign. And so this was obviously a intentional act of teasing out Fuentes' involvement to generate excitement. So now with that set up, to answer your question specifically, it's very concerning because clearly Musk is being compromised by these individuals with a history of federal informant activity, a history of being very divisive people within the pro-white movement and attacking anyone that isn't part of their cult of personality, their operation. This is something that they did very effectively over at Gab, despite the fact that people like Fuentes and Beardson, who are, you know, the integral members of the quote unquote America First movement, ran Torba down and ran Gab down in comparison to Twitter. You know, I mean, these guys, I can't reveal too much, but they're very close with him. And they basically subjugated him. He bent the knee to their agenda and turned his platform, Gab, into an operation, promotion operation for Fuentes and his crew, straight up. And it's really sort of humiliating for Torba, I think, because now they're ditching him. They're pumping and dumping him like a $2 whore and moving on to Elon Musk, apparently. And you can see the writing on the wall of the exact same thing playing out.
So would you say that there is an attempt by these actors such as, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos, who is another one of these federal informants? This is a man notorious for recording every conversation he has for the purposes of blackmail. He has claimed this in the past, and apparently it is true. So, you know, word to the wise, do not speak to Milo Yiannopoulos, right? Do not be anywhere near him, in fact. These people are dangerous, right? Would you say that they're trying to do something very similar to Elon Musk, what they did to Andrew Torba, to compromise him in such way and to make him do their bidding? Now in his function as head of Twitter,
you'd have to think so. All of the signs are there. That tease of Baked Alaska was too eerily reminiscent of the tease/reveals of these other people in coordination with Kanye West and Fuentes and his crew. Then you can see that, you know, during this period, Kanye West, while he's being represented by Fuentes and Milo, is boarding private jets and meeting with Elon Musk in person. These guys are texting each other back and forth because, you know, clearly, you know, Kanye himself is posting the screenshots from their text messages. So you'd have to be a fool, given that level of proximity, to not think that these guys are working together and that Musk is trying to tease this reveal, posting the picture of Baked Alaska. Around the same time, he posted a picture of Pepe. Not that that's anything wrong. It would be great to have Musk as one of our guys. But when you have this compromised crew of individuals with this divisive slash and burn Machiavellian plan to sort of take control of the pro-white movement while burning all of their competition, just scorching them. You have to worry about that, having the richest man on the planet compromised by these known federal informants and bad actors.
This is what really, I would say, I'm going to be a little skeptical on this, because Elon Musk is not just the richest guy on the planet. He's also, you could say he's a powerful person. Among other things, he is a defense contractor. Many of his companies are defense contractors. Starlink is, what's the name of the other one? SpaceX.
Neuralink
is, I think Neuralink is just one of those pump and dumps where you basically gin up rumor and buzz to get a bunch of money invested in the project, take the money and run. I don't think mind machine integration is possible. That's the first thing, right? We influence machines with our minds, and we use it using traditional methods, keyboards and mice and different inputs, I don't think that our mind can directly interface with a machine the way, you know, you see it in these sci-fi movies. But back to my original point, I think that Elon Musk, by virtue of being a defense contractor, a part of the military-industrial context, and in some very sensitive areas, right, space and intelligence through Starlink, to all these things, you would think that he would have better protection against being muscled by people like Nick Fuentes and Milo Yiannopoulos. I mean, everything about those guys screams two-bit. You would think that, and of course, I've recently shared a video on my Telegram speculating that Musk may be connected to certain organized crime figures in Russia and China. So, I mean, if Fuentes and Yiannopoulos and all these people could even conceivably muscle in on Musk, right? I don't see it as possible, given how this is not just a rich guy. This is a rich and powerful man, and he has apparently some very important and powerful and dangerous friends in the Department of Defense, in China, in Russia, all over the place, really. So I guess the question is, what would make, if indeed this is possible, that Milo Yiannopoulos and Nick Fuentes are trying to compromise Musk, what would make them think that they can pull this off? Who is backing them if indeed they can take on Elon Musk?
Well, I do think people behind the scenes that we're not aware of are backing them. That's certainly part of the issue. But I think also that Musk is not a totally detached Howard Hughes style billionaire. He is somebody who is giddy with excitement to be part of a certain scene. You know, he's posting the Pepes, he's posting memes, just like he's any of us. And I think that's part of the appeal for a lot of people, is he seems like one of us. He's doing a similar thing to what I'm alleging with Milo and Fuentes with these other alt-light figures. Now, I know that I believe that Fuentes clearly has pretensions towards being a white nationalist leader, as the movement says, you know, based on the fact that he's taken funding from the American Renaissance Foundation and, you know, spoken at those conferences and so on and so forth. But and some of his rhetoric, clearly, too, being backed by Andrew Anglin, who is clearly, you know, one of the godfathers, OG godfathers of the original alt-right. But he's also insinuated himself into the alt-light, clearly, and being backed by people like Milo, by Cassandra Fairbanks, getting, you know, preening interviews from people like Elijah Schaefer and so on and so forth, that are clearly not part of the white nationalist movement, but more the alt-light. So now you have people like Ian Miles Chong, Benny Johnson, and other alt-light figures, Posobiec, that are all up in Elon's mentions. And, you know, they're basically, they've turned into reply guys for him. And he loves that. And he replies back to them. You know, he's not ashamed to be part of their scene. So I don't think that Fuentes is a guy who's been totally unacceptable for these types of alt-light figures to be associated with. They've sought his counsel. They've sought the association with him. Now, things are changing very rapidly. I think this these stunts that he's doing with Kanye are going to change his brand forever. I think he's totally scorching the plan that he's been promoting since day one of being able to reform the system and work with the Republican Party. He's going to be persona non grata after this, you know, gay op that they did against Donald Trump, and now the stunts that they pulled on InfoWars. So who knows? You know, he's basically going from criticizing Wignats for bad optics to saying, you know, screw that, I'm going to do bad optics, but I've got Kanye West. That's the only difference. So as far as specifically who is behind these people, now you can only speculate, but there's something going on there. there is a crew of people, first of all, within white nationalism who treat people differently based on class. That's clear. If you're a working class person, you know, you don't get defended. You just get dumped and left on your own. And if you're a wealthy person, you get funding. You know, you get Anglin and everybody else coming and promoting your fundraisers. Ricky Vaughn got this. He's a well-heeled guy. Got a ton of donations. You get Tucker Carlson either specifically defending you or specifically defending you by name, or it's clear that he's referencing you. And Tucker has done that for both Anglin and Nick Fuentes. He's done that for Ricky Vaughn, Douglas Mackey, but he's never done that for me. He's never done that for anybody, any of the working class people associated with Charlottesville. So there's that. There's a ton of money flowing into these people, and it's, I've made the point, we don't know where the hell that's coming from. A lot of it is dark money. A lot of the streams, you know, they're not like nickel and dime amounts of money. These guys have whales that are coming in and donating insane amounts of money when like Baked Alaska is walking around the streets defending a pedophile who had sex with a 13-year-old girl. It's insane stuff. So besides that, you know, look, Fuentes was folded into the Alex Jones operation. He was folded in to stop the steal. That's Peter Thiel territory. When you're talking about who's funding Yiannopoulos, you're getting into people like the Mercer family who fund Breitbart. And the Mercer family has recently backed away from Donald Trump, and it looks like they're backing DeSantis. So that is clearly one of the angles that a lot of people are anticipating. Is this a gay op to sabotage Trump by associating him with somebody who is going to be the new, like, David Duke on steroids, and, you know, allow DeSantis to come in like the knight on the white horse to save the day?
This, I would say also, this dovetails with Elon Musk proclaiming that he's going to support sensible centrism in the form of Ron DeSantis because he was disappointed by Joe Biden, apparently. I will say that we may be witnessing, right, in the Stop the Steal, in the leading up to the 2020 presidential elections, and then into Stop the Steal, we saw exactly what you're saying, that America First, the Groypers, Milo Yiannopoulos, all of these people who they were folded into MAGA. Many of them were already folded into MAGA. The entire alt-right, Mike Cernovich, Jack Posobiec, you know, Navy Intel. I've suspected for a very long time that the alt-right is actually a military intelligence operation which saw the rise of, let's call it, Israel skepticism on the right in America in the 20, I would say it started with the Ron Paul campaign and culminated with the rise of the alt-right in 2015-16. And so they basically constructed this ideology of the alt-right, which is a rehash of neoconservatism, if we're being completely honest. It is culturally chauvinistic, where the West is the best. We support Israel and we support individual liberty, right? It jettisons some of the foreign policy proposals which are favored maybe by Democrats, such as focusing on Europe or containing Russia, in favor of just relentless support to Israel and a pivot to Asia, a foreign policy pivot to Asia. Specifically China. They don't like China for some reason or other. And I thought that this was an ideology which the military intelligence people had intended in order to thwart the rise of counter-Semitic or at the very least skepticism of unabashed support of Israel, these types of things. Because, you know, see, Ron Paul, he is, I guess, privately a Zionist, but his policy proposal would have been to just let Israel fend for itself, because that's not America's business, entangling in alliances with nobody, as George Washington would have put it. And really, the background of some of these people was very suspicious. Many of them were Canadian, which Again, why would they be so concerned with American foreign policy if they're Canadian? That's another question. I mean, of course, I'm not American either, so you could ask the same question about me. So, you know, one of these things. And now that basically MAGA was folded into the alt-light, and the alt-light essentially was the MAGA ideology after the election. The anti-immigration stance was jettisoned, the reindustrialization stance was jettisoned and not acted upon almost, and even the foreign policy stance was jettisoned, right? There was no scaling back of American military presence in the world. There were some very close calls about escalation with Iran during the Trump presidency, and it slowly eroded away the MAGA platform from 2016. It turned it into the MAGA platform of 2020, which was disastrous, which probably cost Trump the election. I mean, of course, there was election interference and theft and stuff like that. But had there been the overwhelming support, I don't think that the Democrats could have stolen enough to make up the difference. And of course, in the Stop the Steal period, we saw a merger of America First, like you said, Fuentes being folded into the Alex Jones operation. And even before that, during the so-called Groyper Wars in late 2019, Milo was dispatched to be a part of America First for some strange and indescribable reasons. You mentioned Peter Thiel. I will say that I heard it through the grapevine. There was an article somewhere in late 2019 that he himself had given up on Donald Trump and was no longer supporting him. So I wouldn't say that's a Peter Thiel, although the Mercer's angle is very interesting over there. And of course, we are seeing and have been seeing for a very long time since 2020, 2021, attempts to prop up a parallel right, which is non-identitarian, which is, like you said, there's a class arrogance about it. You know, they have a contempt for ordinary white people, for working class white people, even though they're ostensibly for working class white people. They just don't let working class white people have any voice whatsoever. And I believe that there was an attempt to, these people were tweeting out stuff like, oh, Trump, Kanye, Elon, all the time. They're thinking, oh, we're coming back. We're going to take back Twitter. We're going to own the libs in 2024. We're going to win. But now Kanye has gone off script. I think that's what really happened with Kanye West. I think he went off script. He was told to be the good conservative, right? Have the good alt-light position. But he went off script. And then Nick Fuentes and Milo Yiannopoulos, whether they jumped on that bandwagon or were they in contact with him before and they incited him to do it, not that he needed much incitement, he is going to destroy MAGA. Kanye West is a wrecking ball, which is going to destroy MAGA, and that's going to probably shatter what's left of the alt-light. And for this reason, because I don't think MAGA represents the interests of white people anymore, I cannot fully oppose Kanye, even though, I mean, I dislike the carnivalistic aspect of it. What do you think of that, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, I separate Kanye a little bit from the others. I've seen other people say this, and I think it's true that he's the most sympathetic figure out of the bunch. You know, he is kind of funny, the little thing that he did with the net and the Yahoo bottle for Netanyahu, and his comedic timing and all this stuff. You know, he seems to passionately believe. Sometimes when people first get red-pilled, they take it way overboard. I'm thinking Paul Nealon, for instance. I think that the people that are trying to manipulate him have a different agenda. Kanye is viewed as a very valuable asset, not just by the America First people, but by the whole alt light crew. He reminds me a little bit of the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where everybody's fighting over the golden chalice at the end that Jesus Christ supposedly drank out of. And, you know, there's this earthquake and the chalice falls into a crevice and Indiana Jones is desperately reaching, trying to grab the chalice because he's obsessed with it, even as it's about to cause his death. And of course, you know, Sean Connery, his father, comes around and says, "Let it go, Indy." Basically, it's a moral lesson about obsession. And right now, the alt-light is unable to let their golden chalice go. They're following it into the abyss. And we saw that with Alex Jones. Alex Jones is being totally dishonest. And so is Tim Pool and all these other people claiming they don't know what Kanye is doing. They would never let somebody like me or you or David Duke or even Richard Spencer, you know, go on their program and talk about Jewish power the way that they're letting Kanye on there. They would scapegoat those people. They would make all kinds of outrageous accusations. Oh, they're feds or whatever. But they let Kanye do it, no problem, because they like the celebrity. They like being associated with a black celebrity in particular. And so Alex Jones was not doing an honest question and answer in that Kanye interview. He was trying to reform Kanye. He was trying to bring the golden chalice back out of the crevice. What he was saying, for instance, was, "Oh, you just like the uniforms, the Hugo Boss uniforms of the Nazis. You're a fashion guy." And Kanye is, like you were saying, going totally off script, which is one of the charming things about him, to his credit, is that he's like, "No, I actually like the Nazis. I like Hitler," which is kind of funny. And you should see Alex Jones' face when he says that. He doesn't know what to do because he's clearly giving the guy softballs to bat out of the park and he's wanting none of it. And so I think a lot of these guys are going to follow him way off of the cliff. Like I said, Fuentes is never going anywhere near the mainstream anymore, especially if he ends up being the end of Donald Trump's political career. And he could be blamed for that. And this election cycle is going to go on for a few more years, and he's going to be he's going to become the face of Charlottesville. They always hit Trump for saying there were fine people. Now he's met with one of the fine people. And, you know, that fine person just so happens to have years of videos that the Oppo research people can go through, picking him out, you know, saying all kinds of very divisive things about, you know, wanting basically all of the Protestants in this country to be forced into Catholicism, and, you know, telling young men not to have girlfriends.
Disgusting things.
Bizarre things.
He said some disgusting things that basically, like I said, initially when I watched him before he was famous, before he made it big with the Graper Wars, and you see it and you start thinking, what is this guy saying? Okay, he makes the children laugh, but then he got offensive. He got nasty. It's like, if you're married, your wife should be crushed with a hammer, should be made into mincemeat and fed to. It's like, what purpose does this serve for our cause? Do you not think before you speak? And I think that these are really born out of not thinking before you speak, because I don't know what to say. I will say, however, he's not just associated with Charlottesville. I mean, he was at Charlottesville, Nick Fuentes, but I don't think he was one of the leaders.
No. But they'll make him that.
He is far more associated with January the 6th. He was very prominent there. I remember seeing videos of him riding around on Alex Jones's armored personnel carrier or whatever it was, with a megaphone. And it's insane just how close he was allowed to be to Donald Trump, to Stop the Steal rally on January 6th. And we basically know that Trump knew about this, that there were plans for this rally coordinated with the Trump White House, with the Trump Department of Defense, again with the Department of Defense, with military intelligence. This can be used to smear that entire group of people, that entire political group, just association with Nick Fuentes, Alex Jones, and now Kanye West. Like you said, and Kanye West, I love your metaphor of the holy chalice, of the holy grail. He is a black celebrity. He's probably one of the most famous people on the planet. And even if you don't like rap music, you know who Kanye West is, even before this thing took off. And he comes out and says vaguely conservative things. He put on a MAGA hat. I remember when he first put on the MAGA hat and met with Donald Trump in, I believe it was 2018 or 17, maybe, I forget. The entire alt-right, the entire conservative establishment, the GOP, they damn near shat themselves with joy. A black celebrity, you know, the kids love him. He cannot be racist. He's black. He's all of these things. He's a rapper. He's fun. He's rich. He's a fashion guy. He's a music guy. And he's on our side. He likes us. Right. And now he is, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me a little bit of Owen Benjamin. You remember Owen Benjamin?
Yeah, of course. Kanye is reading his jokes live on air now.
Yeah, and Owen Benjamin, I'm not ashamed to say this guy probably lost his mind during the red pilling process. Got so focused on, and he's another one of these people who has hours and hours of material on YouTube being an unhinged, just convinced that the Jews are breaking his lawnmowers because he's too lazy to rake the lawn before mowing it. It was really bad with Owen Benjamin at one point. But I would say this is maybe the celebrity thing. You know, you get out from your sheltered life as a celebrity and into politics, you realize that you've been systematically lied to. And some people I guess are not psychologically robust enough to handle the red pilling process without losing their shit. Come to think of it, Jason, your red pilling process, did you feel psychological strain when you went through it?
No, I think it's been more gradual than most because, to be honest with you, I was pro-white long before I was comfortable talking about the JQ. You know, it's been something more recent that I've been comfortable talking about that. I think a lot of even the Kanye West situation has made it more apparent that this is a critical issue to talk about for me as a free speech advocate because of how powerful the Jewish censorship lobby is. But I think that my red pilling process was a little bit more gradual for that reason, and it was less traumatic.
I remember when I was going through my red pilling process in the 2015-16 era, it was hard on me because I was assimilating not just a lot of new information, but I was shifting from an older paradigm where to one where basically you had all of your instincts had been hitherto wrong. All of your assumptions had been hitherto wrong. And this is a strange process because you start doubting your own gut. You start doubting your instincts. You know, you're full of doubt and you're surrounded by chaos and you can actually sink into it. You can go from, well, I've been systematically lied to my entire life, which is a true fact. It's the fact we have been lied to our entire lives and systematically so. And you can fall off of that precipice into the pit of nothing is true. Everything is a lie. Everything is a psyop. Nothing is real. This is, I think, where people go insane, right? They maybe not shoot up a school crazy, maybe not smear themselves with feces crazy, but they get a little unhinged and they stop believing in the possibility of truth. This is actually a very bad place to be because bad actors can come in from the side because you don't believe in truth. They can mold you. They can direct you to their own agenda. And maybe that's what's going on with Kanye West. Maybe he's being manipulated by forces we have yet to comprehend, but which are related to America First and Milo Yiannopoulos. Who knows?
Yeah. I think he's certainly being manipulated. I think that, you know, he's lost a lot of money clearly because of these Jewish pressure campaigns against him. But he still has, word is, about $400 million. And he's talking about doing a presidential campaign. I think people like Milo Yiannopoulos in particular saw dollar bills. They saw green when that happened, you know, before this situation. I don't know if anybody's seen what Laura Loomer has been posting of her text messages with Milo. He was saying, I think Kanye is gay and, you know, I should kill him because he's gay and all this other stuff. And then suddenly he, you know, oh yeah, he's a big fan of Kanye. He loves Kanye, wants to work for him, help his vision, you know, and then Milo secondarily,
Milo Yiannopoulos wants to, it has a problem with people being gay all of a sudden.
Yeah, he's, well, he has a thing for black men, you know, and people have noticed that Kanye has a very sensitive sort of affectation in his voice. So maybe Milo is correct. Who knows? But I think that for Fuentes, it could be about money, but I think that it's more about ladder climbing. He's a Machiavelli. And it's about his ego and wanting to be at the forefront of the conversation at all costs, even if it goes against everything that he's preached to his disciples, his following about optics for all of these years. And he's part of a generation that has a weird thing about rap music, you know, where even the people who claim to be pro-white, you know, they don't listen to music from white artists. They're obsessed with black culture, and it's intoxicating to them. And I think Fuentes, for this reason, couldn't help himself. Just like Donald Trump, he would do anything to be associated with black rappers. You know, Trump and Fuentes are convinced that there's nothing cooler than a black rapper, and they'll throw their own people to the wood chipper to get at that black rapper and be associated with them. I mean, Trump clearly, you know, pardoned these black rappers like Kodak Black and Lil Wayne while allowing the January 6 people to rot in jail in detention without trial. Now he's suddenly coming back in his new campaign and saying how much he cares about them. And if he's reelected this time, he'll make sure that he helps them out. And similarly, you know, Fuentes just has absolutely torched so many members of his own movement that came before him and he associated with when he came to Charlottesville and so on and so forth. And now he's associating with this black guy for the same reasons that he threw his own people, you know, to the wolves.
That is, you know what that reminds me of? Basically the Machiavellian status craving, yearning to climb the ladder, to be someone, to be known, to be famous, and if that's not possible, notorious. That's narcissistic behavior. That's textbook narcissistic behavior. I would become famous at all costs, occupy attention. It's not even about money. It's not even about political power. These people want to be the center of attention. It reminds me of Richard Spencer, if we're being completely honest. And I guess I'm not the first, nor am I the last person to make that comparison, that basically Fuentes is a dime store Richard Spencer. They were even making fun of it. I believe you shared it on Telegram. Even if you are like a white nationalist, whatever Richard Spencer was, you can still be replaced by cheap Mexican labor.
Yeah.
as was the case, basically. And
yeah, I think that's clearly the situation. You know, I wasn't around the movement back when Richard Spencer was coming up, but, you know, he was part of a crew of the old guard, you know, the older white nationalists, well-heeled with money, and they would hold their conferences. And it was before being a white nationalist was edgy and cool, and you had all this meme culture online. It was from my understanding, Richard Spencer was the one young guy, and then there were all these older guys with money, and you know, he was displaying his assets for them so that they could so he could get that money dollar bill for his operation, and they put him in charge of MPI, and which he did not found, but he ran it into the ground, that's for sure. And, you know, they funded him because he had the look, you know, he came from a certain class. He talked a certain way, and they said to themselves, boy, this guy's got talent. He will really appeal to some people. And yeah, he appealed to them because he's another rich guy. And similarly with Fuentes, you have a sheltered, wealthy little brat who's never held a job in his life and
How wealthy is the Fuentes family? I know the Spencers are rich, but the Fuentes family rich?
Not on the level of Spencer. I mean, Spencer's family has all these farming subsidies and mansions and so on and so forth. And he's a trust fund brat. But I would say that Fuentes is comfortably upper middle class. The point is that he's upper middle class enough that he's never had to work, and his family afforded him the luxury to just, you know, hang around and try to become a movement leader. And, you know, that's what he is to this day. And from what I understand, you know, Mommy Fuentes is, you know, on his sites in the chats, calling herself Funny Groiper, and is picking fights with his former, you know, friends like Jaden McNeil. So Mommy is all in on her special baby boy being an e-celeb.
If my mom were listening to this show, I would be embarrassed, if I'm being completely honest.
Yeah, my mom doesn't want anything to do with my streams or anything. My mom is a normie conservative. No one else in my family is involved in this.
Yeah, I guess it's a blessing, and it's a mixed blessing. On one hand, you do want to show off your successes, your accomplishment to your family. On the other hand, you know, your family sees you frankly discussing the Jewish question or the Black question or the possibility of, you know, military intelligence trying to mind fuck the American public. It might be a mite alienating, right? Worlds colliding. I have a normal life, which is sequestered from my activism, I guess, which is very uneventful. Just the thought of having my mom chew out my enemies online, that's a little embarrassing, to be honest.
I think the main thing, even if he wasn't as wealthy as Spencer, is that he was close enough to that class. He dressed a certain way, like, you know, in the suits and so forth, and talked with an elitism. And, you know, I've been reviewing on my own channel a number of his statements about Southern people, just running Southern people down. But it's not just the South, though. You know, he, like a lot of people, sort of uses the South as a euphemism for white working people generally. And he has a hostility, a disdain, a disgust for people who work for a living. And these rants, they're clearly out of the Richard Spencer playbook. If you have ever listened to the rant that Richard Spencer had after Charlottesville, I mean, we may have political differences with non-white people, and, you know, they have their own agenda, we have ours, but Spencer talks like a stereotypical, like, plantation owner, like from a Hollywood movie, like, you know, an anti-white stereotype of a slave owner. And Fuentes very much talks like that, except, you know, in his worldview, it's almost like the white people, the poor working class white people, are the slaves. He refers to them as farmers who are from a genetic line that aren't smart enough to be like people such as his family, who are artisans. They're so much smarter. So he's a very class conscious person, and that aura appeals to the decision makers, and they see him in themselves. And I think recently, you know, Spencer himself has started to see himself in Fuentes. He's had some conciliatory conversations with him online when the news of Fuentes and Kanye initially broke. Fuentes expressed his, quote, admiration. And I think that it's just a situation of narcissists falling in love with his own reflection, because they're basically a 1.0 and a 2.0 of the same person, crafted and promoted by the same people.
There's also, I believe, the element of, since Fuentes is now associated with Kanye West, Spencer wants to be associated with Kanye, with Fuentes and Kanye West, because narcissism gloms onto fame. And I think that's the number one priority in the life of a narcissist. He wants to be the center of attention. He wants to be famous. He wants to be, if not possible to be famous, then notorious. This is actually pretty dangerous. As they get older and that chance to become famous slips away, they sometimes turn to crime in order to become notorious. Many serial killers are actually narcissists, and they want to get caught because they want to be famous. It's not to imply that Spencer or Fuentes are going to kill anybody. I don't think they have the balls to be serial killers. But they've achieved notoriety in this different way.
I wanted to mention that you were bringing up that I really should dovetail into what you're saying about criminality. So if you look at all of the statements that the media makes about Fuentes when they're trying to associate him with Trump, they do always bring up Charlottesville, and they don't actually bring up January 6th, which is something you were saying is that logically they should. I agree. He was a much bigger part of January 6th. He's one of the thought leaders and the organizers there. He wasn't at Charlottesville. So why are they talking about Charlottesville and not J6? And even though really J6 has eclipsed Charlottesville in importance in a lot of ways. And I think the reality is that Fuentes is being protected by some powerful people over J6. It's sort of an inescapable thing, because in some of the videos that I've played on my program, and I actually have the clip of Fuentes at January 6th on my Odyssey channel. For anybody who wants to check that out, just search Jason Kessler. And Fuentes is clearly committing what they always accuse Ray Epps of doing, incitement to riot, a felony. He's saying to his audience there, right on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, disregard the police, overturn the barricades, keep marching, don't relent. We're forcibly evicting the politicians from the people's house. They should live in fear of us. Why wouldn't they charge somebody like that? I think that it's the same reason that they're not charging Baked Alaska. You have these most prominent guys who it looks like made themselves ripe targets for prosecution, and they're just letting them go. Baked Alaska is on paper admitting that he is going to be a federal informant. Now, the thing with Fuentes, I think, is more of an inference. Like, why didn't they charge him with that incitement? But then also, you know, the January 6th committee subpoenaed Fuentes to testify and to turn over documents. And now the J6 committee is wrapping up, and that never happened. Why would this congressional body go through all the trouble, all the trappings of preparing this guy to take the stand, and it never happens, and the media even treats it like it just went away? And I think that's very clear, is because he is cooperating in some capacity with the government. They don't just let you go. They let you go if your attorney contacts them and says, look, my client is not going to testify. He's going to give you everything you want behind the scenes, whatever documents you want, and he will privately testify off the record, blah, blah, blah. He just doesn't want his name in the paper. And boom, that's it. And when you have somebody that's that compromised, just like Baked Alaska is compromised, and you see all this weird suspect behavior, these guys like involving themselves in operations which are going to affect the leader of the free world, you really have to question the agenda and how compromised these individuals are. So I think Fuentes has had some criminality, technically speaking.
Okay, so that's another factor, because really just the amount of kvetching we've seen from the media, from the liberals, from the Jews, let's face it, about January the 6th has, like you said, completely eclipsed Charlottesville. Charlottesville was a fart in the wind compared to January 6th, let's not. And there was actually no criminality on the part of the protesters at Charlottesville, where you could argue that there was criminality on the part of the protesters as January 6th. I mean, they were trespassing. Now, let's not get into that, because that's a whole nother bowl of wax. And since if the organizers have not been touched and prosecuted, like, they're prosecuting nobodies, they're jailing people who were there but, you know, have no clout. Meanwhile, Alex Jones, Nick Fuentes, Ali Alexander, the black guy, the black guy with the weird jaw. People are saying that he's been recorded as a pedophile somewhere else. All these shady characters, and of course, there's Donald Trump himself. None of these people are paying for January 6th, even though the media is saying, "Oh, this is a riot. Senators were fearing for their lives. There was attempted murder of Mike Pence. Somebody stole Pelosi's laptop." And meanwhile, you know, guys like what's his name, culture war criminal, was beating this drum. Christian Sikor, he's being sent away for, I believe, 3 years, maybe more, actually. Why? Because he sat in Nancy Pelosi's chair, I believe. That's the crime of the century. But the insiders, the organizers of this supposed crime of the centuries, are running around free, and now they're going to manage a presidential campaign for Kanye West. Something is fishy here. Something is definitely going on. I wanted to speak about your objections about really the structure of white nationalism. So you've been on this let's call it a hobby horse for a long. I've been following you on Telegram. I've been following happenings that essentially you see organized white nationalism as a little bit of an old boys club. You know, it's very classist, in your opinion. Would you mind expanding that view a little bit?
Yeah, so I'm not trying to go in a total jihad about it. Like, some of the people who are, you know, in the upper class of the movement have also been very good to me, and I consider friends. You know, that would probably include Peter Brimlow and Greg Johnson. You know, they're great friends and have been supportive and helped me to do fundraising for the Charlottesville related issues. But I also feel like, you know, besides just helping out with a situation specifically like Charlottesville, there is an objective amongst the older guard to promote new blood. That seems to be a consistent theme. And as I've said before, they've done it with Richard Spencer. They did it again with Nick Fuentes. And there's a lot of funding that's going on behind the scenes, and we wouldn't really know about it except for the fact that, you know, there's so many left-wing people trying to report on our operations and so forth. And I read into that stuff, and I check up on it sometimes, because occasionally there is useful information, even if it comes from the mouth of the devil himself. A fact is a fact. And what I've noticed is just what I said before, that, you know, when you look at the people who were at Charlottesville, there were a lot of working class white men waving Confederate battle flags, and all the media could say was rednecks, you know, dumb hicks, white supremacists, the usual stuff. But, you know, they were saying that you're poor, basically, that you don't have class. And I feel like there was a certain element of the white nationalist movement that felt the same way. I mean, why didn't they back us up more? Why was there such a retreat, a failure to defend? But even more so amongst the GOP. Why didn't the GOP, which dovetails to some extent with white nationalist politics, let's be honest. I mean, Tucker Carlson is considered an influential figure amongst most of the people in the white nationalist movement. And he echoes a lot of the same talking points and sentiments. And he jumped in to back up January 6th. They all did. All of the alt-light and MAGA influencers jumped in to back up January 6th, even when it came to people who had clear associations and ties to the white nationalist movement, like Nick Fuentes and Baked Alaska. And Jones himself, the same deal, backed up the J6 people. But when it came to Charlottesville, not only did they not defend us, they piled on They saw us as completely useless, not like them. We didn't talk the same way. We didn't walk the same way, dress the same way. And they, none of the people that they knew had ever heard of us. I heard Sean Hannity say that one time when I was in a van after Charlottesville with a family member, and they had Hannity on the air. And he was like, "Who is this Jason Kessler guy? I don't know anybody that I know who's ever heard of him," because they're just not in the same circles. It's a different class. And they don't feel like they have to back us up. We are their muscle. You know, when they want to get us into the streets, they want warm bodies to show how strong their movement is and how many people they can bring out. You know, Trump brings out a ton of working class people. But when it comes to January 6th, you know, somebody like Trump will say, "Hey, I'm marching with you guys. I'm one of you. I'll be right there going to the U.S. Capitol." Boom. And he's getting in his limo and heading to the bunker first thing, you know, and he's going to leave them high and dry. That's the way it goes with the conservative movement and white nationalism generally. And I'm sick of it. And that's why I'm talking about this stuff, because I'm not just running my mouth, expressing some chagrin. I'm trying to build actually a little bit of a revolution against this, because, you know, I'm not doing terribly. I work for a living. I can survive. And I don't need the support of these people with all of the money. I'm going to be out here and I'm going to dedicate my time. And there's quite a few of us out here who are tired of business as usual. They're tired of being taken for granted while these other people, you know, are allowed to just come in and replace us. That's what the agenda was, is don't back up the Charlottesville people, or half-heartedly back them up. But we're going to put most of our eggs in the basket of getting this guy who is fresh and doesn't have the same problems. And, you know, he's of the same kith and kin as we are, the same pedigree. So I think that things have to change. And I don't want working class white men, Southern white men, to feel like they don't have a choice, that they got to, you know, gravitate towards these elitist pricks who have a lot of negative things to say about people like us. And, you know, I haven't heard most of these guys say things like Fuentes has. So he's alone on that. But, you know, look, no one had a problem with him saying this stuff. No one stopped giving him the paychecks when he started talking like this, running us down. So things have got to change. And I intend to be part of that change.
That's interesting, this class dynamic. Now, I've had Jim Goad on this show. We discussed Hillbilly Elegy, which is J.D. Vance's memoir of his life in rural, well, not really rural, but redneck country. He calls it hillbilly country, growing up in Ohio and Kentucky. And something we discussed with Jim Goad is that, first of all, he is convinced to this very day that the optics war was an attempt to muscle out working class white guys from white identitarianism, from the distant right, from the alt-right at the time, as people were calling it. And second of all, something that he observed, which I guess I agree with, that most people in the creative professions aren't there because they're creative, right? I mean, they are creative, but they aren't there because they are. They're there because they have the privilege to be creative. They have the privilege of leisure. And as someone who has grown up in privilege, right, I'm not a poor guy. I don't come from a poor family. I don't think I would be who I am today if I hadn't had simply the leisure, the security, and the confidence, which comes from essentially never really having to worry about money or access to institutions, really. Because, you know, in Eastern Europe, class is not so much delineated by money, but by how quickly the gears of the system turn when you need them to turn, if they turn at all. And I've noticed that I show up at an institution with my name and gears turn, which is, you know, I feel my privilege, so to speak. And I run this show. I have the time, the leisure to run this show because I am financially secure. I am financially secure because I come from privilege. I may have earned part of this financial security, but would I have been able to without the privilege of my birth? I don't think so. So that may be a factor there, because a working class guy, he's got to work. He does not have infinite leisure time like a lot of these rich kids do. And that's another thing. When you have lots of leisure time and you've been around people like that your entire life, you know how to schmooze with them. Whereas the working class, it's always going to have rough edges. And that's really what's endearing about the working class in many ways. But some of the American white nationalist scene, I would say, probably don't like it. And I guess the reason is that America doesn't really have a ruling class. Everyone in America is either working class or middle class. There is no top. There is no aristocracy to speak of. So even the ultra super rich have that middle class, ultra class consciousness. You mentioned Fuentes is very class conscious. You know, he's going to change the way he speaks to people. Depends on what class they come from. And I have this theory that basically even America's ruling class, they fundamentally have this mentality. They fundamentally have the middle class mentality of being class anxious, both class anxious, anxious about falling into the working class, and being status grubbing, right? So they want to climb even further up. And as a result, they have a contempt for the working class because they want to distance themselves as much as humanly possible from the working class. That's why they have a contempt for the idea of working with their hands, for, like you said, farming, right? Whereas basically, you know, you, in Europe, it's not unheard of people who are wealthy, who own a lot of land, to actually take part in the cultivation of that land. Because can you really manage a thing if you've not really worked on it? I don't think this happens in America. But of course, I could be wrong. So this could be an aspect of it. These people get chosen because A, they have ample time. B, they have they're of the right class. So like Hannity says, if he knows you or he knows people that know you, well, that's a point in your favor. Whereas someone who comes from more humble origins, well, he's going to be ignored because who's this guy? He's not one of ours. And what's he going to do? You know, he's going to do this in his spare time? Please. It's one of those things, I guess.
Well, I'm not an absolute class warrior, even though I understand that these are very important issues. And, you know, I want to get along with the people at the upper strata as well. But I think that it's something you really have to fight a lot more for acceptance if you're coming from this background that I do. And it's not that it's impossible. Like, you know, this, so I run a small business and I have been hustling very hard to, you know, make it thrive since Charlottesville ended, to restart my life. I don't want the bad guys to win, to crush me. And I'm doing okay for myself. But, you know, I was hustling like 7 days a week, working during the spring and summer, and now I have a little bit more time in the winter. So it's possible, but the race that you've got to run to be able to provide a living for yourself and then have the free time to do this sort of thing is very difficult. But as of right now, at least I'm optimistic that it's a race that I could potentially win. I'm starting to get some traction. You know, during the time where I wasn't able to devote myself to the movement, my numbers following on social media platforms was decaying due to attrition. I lost a lot of people. Now that I'm doing videos again, people are like suddenly aware of me again, and I'm starting to get, you know, the numbers ticking back up again at a very consistent clip. So I'm happy about that. But, you know, people fault folks like me and maybe even Jim Goad for carrying some ideas of the left. You know, Jim, I know, is very proud of not really fitting in left or right. And people attacked me for voting for Democrats way back in the day before really the racial politics was what it is today. You know, you could still be like a white working class person with self-respect and vote for the Democrats. Not today, obviously. But, you know, if you look at people like, say, Jimmy Hoffa is an example of somebody that if you're a working class person, you could emulate as a path to power, to success. You know, this is a guy who drove trucks just like lots of other working class guys drove trucks, but he looked around and he saw the other working guys getting screwed by the bosses at the top. And so he started creating the rhetoric of, hey, we have something in common here, boys, and we have some power because we are the majority. We're the ones who are doing the work that these people need. And similarly, when you talk about whether it's white nationalism or Republican politics, the majority of white right-wing men are working class. They're not elites. If we had more elites, boy, would things change a lot quicker. We don't have that. And we're just a consistently underappreciated demographic, and that goes with the leadership situation. So Jimmy Hoffa got very excellent at organizing these people, and you know, he became wealthy. And there's a big strand of the far right that, you know, idolizes the mafioso sort of aesthetic and the machismo, and from a certain perspective, the mafia is kind of right wing. You know, they occupy a lot of our ideological wavelength, and you can see that in shows like The Sopranos, where they're talking about proudly you know, supporting Christopher Columbus against more native friendly American revisionist history and all this other stuff. So I think that's something that, you know, not saying break the law, not that aspect, but we might want to start thinking about.
It does well to remember that the Sicilian Mafia started as a Sicilian nationalist organization fighting against the Risorgimento, the unification of Italy. It later degenerated into racketeering. I mean, it always engaged in racketeering to fund its operations, but at some point there was nothing left but the racketeering and the Sicilian nationalism was really just a memory for them. So for that reason, I would say that specifically the Italian mafia, yeah, you could say it's right wing, but other organized crime outfits such as, you know, the Russian mafia, which are a continuation of the KGB and FSB, the Jewish mafia in America, which is very powerful even today, which has its links in Israel and all over the place, and even the Mexican cartels. I mean, would we really call these people right wing? And even if we would we say that these people share ideology with us? I don't really think so. But yeah, I understand your point there. Just let's not get carried away, huh?
Right. No, I'm just talking in terms of solidarity, of coordination, in terms of aesthetics and carrying ourselves a certain way. I'm certainly not advocating criminality, racketeering or something. We don't need to become the Aryan Nation or whatever.
Right. So that's I guess I'm going to end this segment right with unless you have something more to say on the class question.
No, nothing else on the class question.
I'm going to end this segment by saying that my ideology is white nationalism. I believe in white solidarity. I believe white people should work together and coordinate. And I think that white consciousness should transcend class affiliation. I think that working class whites should work together with middle class and upper class whites towards common goals. I think that everyone has a role to play. And I don't believe anyone should be excluded or insulted. And I strongly disavow what Fuentes said about Southerners, about farmers. And, you know, there's a lot of upper and middle class Southern people in this movement as well. I'm sure they were also offended by his posturing, by his and people who are farmers. God knows we need more farmers, you know. If more farmers were on our ideological wavelength, that would actually give us power. That would actually give us a bargaining chip with the government. I have this older article from 2020 where I say that if we somehow, because of the shrinking industrial proletariat in America and other parts of the West, maybe trying to run old style, like a I call it cargo cult fascism, trying to organize like the fascists did in the 1920s and 30s with the industrial proletariat and using it as a power base. But I say to people, because the industrial proletariat is A, small and shrinking, B, probably going to be replaced by automation sometime soon, we would be, I guess, far better off, just hypothetically, not saying we should take this route, organizing agrarian populism. Because farming cannot be very easily automated. You still have a number of what Jefferson would have called yeoman farmers, right? If we were to somehow spread the white nationalist ideology among independent farmers who are, I believe, overwhelmingly white in America, in Europe, I mean, they're almost 100% white, we would actually be in a position to seriously threaten the food supply, and that gives us power.
Yeah, this is something that I've talked about before. I don't know if you've heard me talk about that, because that's exactly what I've been stressing to folks. At sometime within the last year, I started studying civil disobedience techniques. There's actually an institute, I believe the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, that has seminars and tutorials on how to do this strategy. And you can sign up and take their online course. And I went through that online course and their reading materials, their videos. And basically what these folks do is they try to create regime change in different countries using nonviolent, totally legal tactics, you know, basically by getting people to stop the means of production in the country by boycotts and protest campaigns, things of that nature. And when I started to think about, well, what would the strategy be for a pro-white movement? So I looked at which industries in America are the most white. And I'm sure you can guess one of the most white industries, along with airline pilots, which is another interesting thing, is farming. Farming is like 94-96% white. And so therefore it is extremely powerful. You are holding one of the components to life itself, along with water, in the food supply. So if you were able to organize amongst the white farmers, not only would they not be a group of people that you would ridicule as being stupid or whatever, this is your main constituency. It is one of the primary blocks of power of white people in the United States, and probably for that matter across the Western world. So why would you denigrate them? You should be working with them, lifting them up. And some people do realize that. Stephen Miller, for instance, is one of amongst the base Jews that are out there. He is the greatest white advocate. He's got this America First Legal that has filed a lot of lawsuits on behalf of white people. And he sued the federal government, which was trying to deny funds to farmers based on their race. So every racial group who's a farmer, black, whatever, can get funds from the government except white people. They're going to be low on the totem pole. And they got sued for that by Stephen Miller, because this is a smart guy who's looked at the numbers, who's done game theory, strategizing about how to make white people successful in this country.
It's one of, I mean, we should be doing these targeted appeals. You mentioned airline pilots. That's another profession without which the country, or you know, the world cannot function. And for whatever reason, non-whites are very bad at being pilots. I was reading something about basically how the Russo-Ukrainian conflict spilled over into Chad, of all places, where you have the Russian private military company Wagner being bombarded by Ukrainian military pilots in the Chadian Air Force. Why do the Chadians have Ukrainian military pilots? Because blacks cannot fly planes, apparently. This is common practice in African state air forces to have retired or you know, disgraced white military pilots fly their planes for them. It's one of those things you learn. We should imagine like the entire system of modern life, modern state. It's a barrel, you know. You're filling it up with water, but all you need to do is remove one of the wooden planks which make up the barrel to spill out all of the water. You don't have to destroy the entire barrel. So deny the enemy the ability. This is why I think that the truckers' protest in Canada, the farmers' protests in the Netherlands, it lit a fire under the enemy's asses. You notice that shortly after the trucker protests, most COVID restrictions just went away. And now I don't think we're even talking about COVID anymore.
You're so right. And it's one of the few points that, or it's one of the points that few people understand, unfortunately, is a lot of people look at it as, oh, the trucker protest was a failure. They got everything they wanted. The strategy worked. People have a wrong-headed approach to things where they think if the government cracks down on you, you lose. Like if they jail you or whatever. Look, we live in a privileged first world society where people aren't used to suffering, deprivation, sacrifice, but that's exactly the kind of thing you have to do to win. And people who are trying to overthrow a regime in like Eastern Europe or something, a communist regime that used civil disobedience tactics, or people like in the Middle East who are right now trying to create regime change using civil disobedience tactics. I'm not saying I agree with their goals, but like the people in Iran are using this right now to try and overthrow that theocratic regime. You know, they understand that they have to sacrifice. They understand that going to jail is not necessarily a bad thing for their objectives because it makes them a martyr. People here in the first world, in the Western world, are too weak. We need to make them stronger and ready to sacrifice, and then things will change. So the trucker protest is exactly analogous to what I'm talking about with the airline pilots thing. They used civil disobedience tactics to find a pressure point, a weakness that they could exploit to put pressure onto the government. In this case, what they did was they shut down access to a bridge using their trucks that was a primary point of trade and import and export from the United States into Canada and vice versa. So Canada was losing, I believe, hundreds of millions of dollars every day that this bridge was shut down. Now, this is when the crackdown really began. And so some people got arrested, but it's also when the whole COVID situation in Canada changed and the politicians started coming out and saying no more restrictions. So they won. And if you were going to do that with the airline industry, okay, no cargo is coming in and out of the United States by plane. All the business people who need to go for meetings are shut down. I think that there would be wailing and gnashing of teeth from some very powerful people to the government to say, this has to end. Give them what they want.
That's a good point to make. I will point out, you brought up Eastern European leaders. Three of the presidents of the post-communist Eastern European countries in the 90s, just off the top of my head, Lech Walesa in Poland, Václav Havel in the Czech Republic, and Franjo Tudjman in Croatia, they were jailed. So, you know, and Tudjman in particular, he's been in jail, I believe, he had been in jail for such a long time, from 1978 to 1991. He was in jail for revisionism, for trying to overthrow the Yugoslav government. I think they had him up on trumped up charges. Same with Václav Havel in the Czech Republic. Another thing you notice, I mean, let's tie this into the class thing. You don't see leaders of white identitarian groups suffering. I mean, not to imply that you haven't suffered from Charlottesville or any of the other Charlottesville defendants and leaders haven't suffered egregiously, but for the time being, I mean, you've not been thrown in prison, thank God.
But we could have been, and I think that we're as close as it gets to what I'm describing here, because that was a brutal crackdown by the government. And of course, we know they're colluding with social media companies to censor people. There just wasn't any way that they could throw us in jail, given the legal structure of the First Amendment and how it applied to that protest, but they did everything else that they could possibly do, whether it was, you know, the elites of the country funding a bad faith lawsuit against us, you know, pressuring the social media companies to ban us, using information infrastructure like websites such as Wikipedia to smear and defame us. They did every other possible thing that they could. And when I tried to do the UTR2 rally in Washington, D.C. the next year, there was so much pressure put to bear on me from bad faith media attacks to, you know, empowerment of Antifa groups to threaten and infiltrate and cajole anybody who wanted to associate with the event.
Yes, obviously. Now, but that is a, I mean, you should wear your scars proudly, Jason, because they show you have skin in the game, and skin in the game shows conviction and it shows courage. And this is why I've been trying to help you rebuild your brand so much, because I admire what you have done, the way you've stood your ground, and the way you, I think you refuse to lie. I think there's a refusal to lie about you, and I respect that immensely. I've said it before, I will repeat it again. Elite are those that refuse to lie. If you refuse to debase yourself with deception, with spreading lies, you will live to see yourself become the elite in the sense that you will rise to the top. You will be respected. Men will admire you. And that's how you gain power. It's not, you can't really buy power. You cannot buy a man's admiration and willingness to sacrifice for you and your cause. We talk about, you know, Caesarism. People talk about, oh, Caesar this, Napoleon that. But Caesar and Napoleon, they had skin in the game. They shared the suffering of their men, and they inspired fanatical loyalty by being great men. And I don't see a lot of that in the leadership of this movement, but maybe we're seeing the beginnings of that somewhere here.
Yeah, the unwillingness to take even the first initial sacrifice is a major point that's holding us back. So many people are at the point that's like, the max of my involvement is I'm going to have an Anon account on social media. And the first sign that there's trouble, somebody tries to dox me or whatever, I'm going to disappear. I'm gone, baby. And I'm going to pretend like I never had anything to do with the movement. And that is ultimately a very unsafe ground to build a castle on. It's very weak ground. What you need is people who are willing to persevere through that initial blowback, you know. And I'm not trying to hold myself up like I'm so great or whatever, but, you know, it's worked for me, I believe. And I feel like I'm in a good position to rebuild my brand because they attacked me so vehemently. I thought initially I could do the optics thing and I'm going to, you know, be a civil rights advocate for white people. And they smeared me. I'm the worst neo-Nazi. You know, I hate Heather Heyer and all this other stuff. But at the end of the day, I'm still here, and that stuff that they used has diminishing returns. People don't even care anymore. Like, Antifa really recently doxed me again, and there was almost no blowback from it whatsoever because people are like, oh, yeah, so what? We already know about him. But people are so afraid of going through the fire the first time that they never know that you can make it through to the other side. And then you've built up calluses. You've built up a resistance where there's not much they can do to you after they've already called you a Nazi a million times.
Indeed. Yeah, we are timid. We are a society of timid people. We've been trained to be timid. We've been trained to believe that loss of reputation and being called bad names is the worst thing that can happen to you. Well, there's a lot worse things that can happen to you. But the reality of it all is, even if these bad things do happen to you, the ultimate reward of having saved your people, of having helped your race survive for yet another generation to see another day, you know, to secure the existence of white people and a future for our children, that should be our guiding ideal, right? When you've done that, that is the greatest reward. And of course, the rewards will come for you in the personal sense as well. Not that you should need that motivation, but yeah, we have to live in the world as well. And that is indeed something to think about. something we do not observe. Like I said, we do not observe with, especially not with America First. We see that the leadership gets away with things. They turn federal witness. They turn rat in mafia parlance. Whereas the followers, the people who put their trust in Nick Fuentes and Baked Alaska and whoever, they are the ones who get thrown to the wolves.
Yeah, these leaders, they're the people who are weak and aren't able to make the sacrifice. They're so sensitive. They're so afraid of feeling any pain or sacrificing themselves that they'll throw their own people to the wolves to save themselves. And that's exactly the opposite of the kind of people we need. We need leaders who will stand there and take the pain and persevere and say, look, if I can do it, you can do it too.
Indeed. And such a leader is inspirational. And when men see such a leader, well, they can bear it. They can bear it because, hey, if he can do it, I can do it. That's really the that's leadership 101. We see it all throughout history. All the most respected generals and statesmen were men who were willing to sacrifice themselves for their cause, right? And they inspired great loyalty.
We must protect our men, the rank and file, at all costs. We must inspire them to see that we have their backs, and we're doing the opposite of that right now.
Yes, that's tragic. Now, let's circle back to Elon Musk. Now, because that's really the initial reason why we wanted to have this conversation. I believe it was yesterday he banned Kanye West from Twitter for posting what is going to be apparently Kanye's campaign slogan, which is, I guess, a Raelian symbol of a Star of David fused with a swastika. And you were commenting on this, and many people are saying, and Elon Musk is confirming this with his tweets, that there is very little change to Twitter policy, Twitter censorship, now that Elon Musk has taken over. He has reversed some of the lifetime bans, but he has stated that, now 80% of sensible centrists will have Twitter, and the extremists have been banned, hate speech is down. He has intensified shadow banning of right-wing accounts, especially of white identitarians. But he has allowed the center-right, the controlled opposition right, back on Twitter, whereas they were banned previously. And I have speculated, and other commentators have speculated, American Krogan in particular has been very good on this, that this is the worst-case scenario of the Elon Musk takeover, for a very simple reason, that under a free speech regime, we win because we actually have the best argument, we have the facts on our side. Under a regime of left-wing censorship, we don't win, but at least the center-right doesn't win as well. And since the center-right is, I consider it, the greatest blockade to the rise of white identity politics worldwide, and this is actually recognized by political scientists, they observe that populism and nationalism are the strongest in those countries where there is no robust center-right party, right? So you have a Donald Trump, but you couldn't get Marine Le Pen because the French right is much stronger than the GOP. And, of course, the GOP, it's much stronger than the Italian right, which is why Italy has had not just one, but three national populist-type leaders. It's had Silvio Berlusconi, has had Matteo Salvini, and now Giorgia Meloni, right? And so under a left-wing regime, while we suffer, we're actually tougher. We can take the suffering. We can reconstruct our networks over on Gab and Telegram and all these places. But the center-right suffers disproportionately because they're soft. They do not have our toughness. They do not have our resilience. And they depend on size for their legitimacy, whereas we depend on truth for our legitimacy. But this is actually the worst case scenario, I would say, because we are being censored, but the center right isn't being censored. So we are being injured, while the primary obstacle to the rise of white identity politics is not being injured.
But I take your point, and I think you have a lot of good insights, particularly about how Musk is most bolstering the center right. I think that's correct. But I have a little bit more of a nuanced take on Musk. I am unable to take a totally absolutist view on him, good or bad, because some things he does I very much like, and some things he does I don't like. And I also think, you know, look, he's not turning Twitter into Gab. That's clear. He's not turning it into a free speech absolutist platform. And to the extent that he said he was going to, he either lied or gave false expectations, and he shouldn't have done that. But I do think that it can be a win for us. We just got to know where the line is. And that's been a consistent problem with people in the movement, from what I've seen, is they're not able to adequately judge where the line is. Like, we've got a lot of spurgs and autists who have just gone down the rabbit hole too much and aren't in contact with what the optics are of normal people and what their beliefs are. So, you know, I think that I've navigated it pretty well. You've seen a lot of people banned on Twitter. I've never been banned on Twitter, even during the worst of the previous censorship regime. And then you have people, I might not have too many positive things to say about Richard Spencer, but I think Richard Spencer knows where the line is, and he has danced right up to it, but never gone over it. And so he has a similar sense of where that is. Whereas you have a lot of people on our side who come in and aren't able to make JQ points in a subtle, intelligent way, where they come in and they want to use ethnic slurs, and then they're like, oh, come on, why did you ban me? It's because you weren't smart about it. The thing that's valuable about Twitter is not the free speech absolutism aspect. It's that it's not an echo chamber like some parts of Telegram are, like Gab definitely is, like Truth Social is. It's an opportunity to affect people who might possibly be able to be swayed to our side. It's about the opportunity to debate people who are definitely not on our side, and to pull outrageous statements that they're making, which we find morally offensive and which normies find morally offensive, and use those for our own purposes, for our own propaganda. It's an incredibly valuable tool. And I think that Musk has not made this like the free-for-all that a lot of us would hope to be, but I think that he has shifted the balance of power in a way that could be useful to us if we know where the limits are. Now, the limits aren't what Kanye West was doing. Kanye West is going way overboard with the things he's doing. He's not being subtle. He's trying to be a showman and a carny, as we use the term. But for me, I can just give you some examples. Now, granted, as I said, my engagement with the public has been upticking since I started doing videos, but my follower account on Twitter has been going consistently down for years and years and years. It's finally started going back up again at a consistent clip, you know, and so I'm happy about that. And I see growth potential on Twitter. Second, he's shifted the balance of power from these urbanite gatekeepers in the quote unquote journalism profession who lorded their status symbols of the blue checks over everybody else. They were the blue check was basically supposed to be a sign that you could trust these people, and anyone who didn't have the blue check was an agent of misinformation, conspiracy theories, and basically just a low IQ, low class person. And I had a blue check temporarily, because I am a noteworthy person, as Twitter had defined it. I was in the news a lot, and I'm still in the news to some degree. They bring me back up from time to time to try and beat on me, but they took it away because these journalists were in an uproar. They did not want me to come into their country club. They did not want people to pay attention to me the same way that they paid attention to them. And so it was stripped from me, not because of anything I said, but because of who I was. Now, Elon Musk, to his credit, has reversed this, what he calls, kings and paupers policy. And he's allowed me to get my blue check mark back. And the media has not liked that. They were apoplectic about it. Huffington Post even called me a Twitter outlaw. And so they hate it. And many Antifa have been banned for doxing in a way that they never were under the previous regime. The Antifa who weren't banned are leaving voluntarily. They're self-deporting because they see things like Jason Kessler getting his blue check mark back, and they hate it. They can't stand it. And they're trying to do a petty little crybaby boycott of the platform. So I think him banning Kanye for having this symbol, which as you've mentioned, isn't even properly like an original attempt to hide a swastika inside a Star of David. It's this Raelian space cult symbol, you know, and I don't think anybody who would post on Twitter that symbol as a Ray alien would have been banned. I think that it's because of Kanye West and who he is and the fact that he is expressing ideas that are sympathetic of the Third Reich and this kind of thing, that he was targeted and banned. And it's not fair. And I don't agree with that. And I don't agree with like deciding whether Donald Trump should come back or not based on an opinion poll. It has nothing to do with that. But in general, I think that I'm taking a wait and see, more nuanced approach, and I'm optimistic about the opportunities for my personal ability to grow my brand and my following on Twitter.
Right. Well, yeah, I think that a wait and see approach is more prudent. For my part, you know, based on what we have already established, that Elon Musk is linked with these people, with the MAGA crowd, with the alt-right, and the fact that, you know, he is who he is, a defense contractor, one of these Anglo-South Africans, which I hear are the most rapaciously capitalistic Anglos. I suspect he's going to have his thumb on the scale in favor of the center-right, which I consider the worst-case scenario. But it is what it is. What can I say? Let's wait and see. I've been accused a lot of being like a negative Nelly in the past, and I got to admit, I am a bit of a negative Nelly. I look at a situation and immediately think of the worst case scenario. That's why I'm generally happy in life, because the worst case scenario only really comes together in about 20% of the cases, and in 80% of the time, things exceed my expectations. So that's a way of doing things. That's my worst case scenario prediction for Twitter, and I hope I'm wrong, but who knows? We'll see. And let's tie this off with a little levity. Jason, did you see the Alex Jones interview? I only saw bits and pieces of it. I didn't see the whole thing with Kanye, but why the hell was he wearing that mask? Why in holy hell was he wearing it? People have been speculating that this may be an op to make anti-Semitism or even just basic bitch awareness of the Jewish question seem and sound unhinged, because you have people like Kevin McDonald, Andrew Joyce, Greg Johnson gaining traction, well-spoken and articulate people speaking about the Jewish question with subtlety, with nuance, with intelligence, with facts, right? And with conviction. And okay, the story goes, the thought goes, the enemy sees fit to deploy this unhinged black low IQ carny in a gimp mask to make the Jewish question look ridiculous. I first of all, you know, let's not get into whether it's true or not immediately, but what the hell was up with that mask? I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, what's the thought process there? For, you know,
I'm pretty sure I know. So sidestepping the question of whether it's an op to make criticism of Jews look crazy, which it could be, but I think that's more of a factor of what's going on with Milo Yiannopoulos and Nick Fuentes. I don't think that Kanye himself is part of such a thing. I think he's just being himself. But for folks who are familiar with a band called Slipknot, which is an American metal band, they wear masks like monster movie masks or whatever, look like something that Ed Gein would wear, or Leatherface. and they go out and they sing all of their music in these masks. And I've listened to some interviews with the lead singer, Corey Taylor, who some people don't like because he's got some stupid leftist opinions. But it's a good band, actually, I feel. And he explained why the band wears the masks. And it's basically so that they can role play without the shame or the nerves or the guilt of being like this extreme thing. That's the way that he put it, is that they can put out their most raw, provocative emotions and feel like they're playing a role. They don't have to be the version of themselves that's inhibited and so forth. And what I see is that Kanye West was doing a very similar thing. He had his own sort of Slipknot mask, his bad guy mask. Because I think that it emboldened him to do what he wanted to do, which I think was take this new leap into saying things that are like the most taboo possible things you could say in the world right now. You know, I like Adolf Hitler, I like Nazis or whatever. So whatever his motivations for doing that, I'm sure that that was a very scary thing to do. I also think there might be a part of it that he's got some identity issues where he might in some capacity identify as a white man. I don't know how that is. You know, he does talk about being a black man sometimes, but there's black guys out there who are critical of Jews. There's the Nation of Islam and Farrakhan and these kinds of people. And I don't see Fuentes hanging out with them. I see him hanging out with white nationalists or people who are make their bread and butter from white identity politics. And this is a guy who was married and had his kids with a white woman, you know? So I think that there's something going on with his identity. And so maybe wearing that mask allowed him to pretend, you know, that he's a white person or to get more in touch with not being a black person. Just my theories about why he was wearing the mask.
So this is actually, you see it in European carnivals. People wear masks and they become disinhibited, right? This is, in medieval times, there would actually be sexual impropriety during the carnivals, because everyone's wearing a mask, well, you can do it, no problem. And this is really the point of having a bal de mask, right? A masked party, so that everyone would become disinhibited. That's actually a very good observation. My first impression of why Kanye was wearing the mask was, I think it was a sort of metaphor for him being erased by the enemy, right? That by people who, because he talks about this a lot, being separated from his children, being essentially committed into involuntarily committed as an insane person, being framed up as being insane. Maybe he's a little mentally unstable, really, but you know, bad enough to be drugged out of existence. And I find that the experience of really struggling against, I guess there, it feels like someone's trying to rub you out, not in the sense that's kill you, but erase you with an eraser, just put a blank face over your actual face, wipe out your brain, wipe out your mind, and replace it with something bland. And it's what I felt like personally when I was going through my own misadventures with the psychiatric system, you know, when they were doping me up and turning me into a zombie. It's like they're trying to erase who you are and put something else in place, and all the while pretending that no, they're actually helping you and helping you find your true self. And it's a very disturbing vision, the featureless face, the face without eyes.
That's interesting you say that. It reminds me of something I saw when I was on my vacation last year to the Dominican Republic, which is the first, you know, it has the first city of the Americas where Christopher Columbus visited first in his, you know, voyage. But at some of the gift shops, they try to sell you different things, and they had these wood carvings that were like these featureless, faceless entities. And when I asked one of the tour guides why they were carved like that, he said that it's because basically the Dominican people were a people without an identity. They had folks coming from the Latin world. They had people, you know, slaves that were coming over from Africa, and they were sort of an amalgamation of all these different people. So they didn't feel like they had a real identity. So they used these dolls without a face to represent themselves.
That's very interesting, because, you know, that reminds me of the Rastafarian belief that by being moved to Africa, blacks were spiritually damaged, and their healing requires a return to Africa. So that's something to consider. But yeah, you look at Kanye wearing that mask, and a face being, you know, atop an obviously animated body. A featureless face, which is not animated. You do not see his facial features move under that mask, but he is very agitated, very animated with the body. It produces this very creepy, uncanny valley effect. And I think what he's trying to intimate, like, is that basically this is his erasure as a person, the attempted erasure of Ye as a person by the music industry, by organized jewelry, by the people who, you know, I think what really hit him was that they tried to take his kids away from him. And someone on Twitter pointed out, like, years ago, before Kanye ever broached the Jewish question, back when he was doing the MAGA-based black guy thing, that when he was mugged in Paris, I believe Kanye West was mugged in Paris, he felt white. Like, he felt what it was like for all those white mugging victims all over the world. And yeah, I think he is actually a quarter or maybe a fifth white, Kanye. I'm not sure. He has some white admixture, and it's more than the average for American blacks, apparently. He's also, you know, middle class. He's college educated, not exactly a ghetto a ghetto hood rat. He probably can empathize with the average white person a lot better than many blacks. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. However, people are pointing out that it makes him look like the Gimp from Pulp Fiction. So that's probably and it's, I guess, not just Kanye. Milo and Nick and Alex Jones allowed him to wear that. So there's something going on there.
They probably don't really have that much control over him. He's a creative guy. You know, he is a narcissist. He's one of the most popular artists of his generation. I don't think that they have that much control. I think they're trying to steer him the best that they can, but they don't want to kill the golden goose by trying to inhibit him too much. That's one of the problems that he had with his Jewish handlers. Before his current Jewish handler, I guess. But GOV, I got to wrap up soon because I got a few responsibilities to take care of out in the real world before it gets dark where I live.
Yeah. So, okay. So we are at the end of our, close to the end of our allotted 2 hours anyway, Jason. So if you would like to say anything to wrap this show up, and then we can end it.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the program. It's been a great discussion. I think we got into a lot of truths that you can only get into after you've been discussing and going around the bush for a few times. We got into some revelations, and I appreciate that. I like the in-depth conversation about the mask and getting into the psychological component of things. But I would encourage people to check out my live stream program, and you can find all the links to my social media if you go to jasonkessler.us and click the about or the contact section, and you'll see my Telegram, my Twitter, and my DLive, where I live stream. And then you'll find links to my Odyssey and BitChute, where you can check out some of my previous interviews, including the one that we did for our election special. And so, hopefully people can reach out to me on social media and let me know what they thought of the interview. And it's just been a great pleasure having this conversation with you today.
It's indeed been a great pleasure for me as well, Jason, to have you on the show. You're always an audience favorite and an editorial favorite, if I might add myself. And I guess this has been the writer's block. As a reminder, this was not live. This is a premiere. It's pre-recorded. So maybe things will happen between this recording and the premiere that none of us could have foreseen. But you know what they say: you live, you learn, you see things. And I want to thank everyone who tuned in live, and I want to thank anyone listening to the replay. We do this for you so that you may become better activists, so that our cause may prosper. I want to thank everyone who donated. Your donations, your contributions are what makes this operation and the broader Countercurrents project possible. I want to thank Jason for appearing and spending these 2 hours with us. I want to thank everyone who's in the chat. I couldn't see the chat because time travel is it's still an experimental technology over here at Countercurrents Laboratories, but I appreciate you nevertheless. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators who are doubtless keeping everyone well-informed and keeping the chat safe. I want to thank Gaddius, Maximus, Bartleby, and Reed Johnson. Thank you, guys. This show really depends on you. And this has been the writer's block. Take care, people. Bye-bye.